Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 25 of the Iga and Carlos Tennis Show. And this is a special episode because Iga and Carlos have finally won a title in the same week. It's their first time doing it since we started the show back in May. So, Damien, let's start away right with that. What are your thoughts immediately on
Woohoo! No, I
that?
mean, we haven't really been like actively waiting for this. However, we did mention this as a possibility, sort of, between each other, when it was Doha and Buenos Aires. Of course, with the way that these events were structured, sort of with the time zone, also Doha finishing on Saturday, Świątek won Doha on Saturday. Well, Alcaraz still had two matches to play in Buenos Aires, so that's when we were thinking that, oh, maybe this will happen now, and that's when we started backtracking and just thinking, oh, so this kind of almost happened in our very first episode in Madrid, but Świątek lost to Sabalenka, of course, in the final. Carlos won, but after that, well, the grass season was of course dry for Świątek in terms of titles. Since Wimbledon, Carlos hadn't won the title, so there really wasn't any space in order for them to do it. I think all in all, this is like their sixth time getting this done, third time at the same event, because three were, Barcelona, Barcelona, Stuttgart twice, and also Doha, Buenos Aires once, but not this year, but 2023. And also, yeah, US Open 2022, Miami 2022, and now Indian Wells 2024. Honestly, if this was going to happen somewhere, Indian Wells was always going to be a big bet, like one of our best bets. Because, well, on slow clay, like Iga's advantage over the field is amazing. Carlos, he's going to be one of the favorites, but it's not that huge. Whereas the Indian Wells court, it just, well, I mean, we're going to be talking about this today, but like it just kind of feels like both of them for the foreseeable future will be the main contenders and like, distinctly main contenders to win titles on these courts.
Yeah, and these conditions both are great for all their strengths and weaknesses are diminished, like how we talk about with the kick serve being super effective for both the heaviness on their forehand, the racket acceleration that they can produce from anywhere on the court, like the yeah, I mean just all of their great assets that make them generational talents. You can kind of see it on the forehand when they play at Indian Wells, and now like they've won it 2 of the last 3 years. And for both of them, they actually play the same opponent in the final. For Iga, it was Maria Sakkari. For Carlos, it was Medvedev again. I guess let's start with Alcaraz's run, because this was a much needed title for Carlos. He hasn't won a title since Wimbledon. This was his first final since Cincinnati, and we weren't quite sure how he was going to look with the preparation coming in, from the ankle roll in Rio, and that right away was put to bed. Right after he lost that first set against Matteo Arnaldi, the form got instantly better and we saw him rack up wins. It was kind of like a revenge tour for him almost until the final, right? Because he comes through, Felix Auger-Aliassime, then Marozsán, then Zverev, who'd recently beat him twice at the ATP Finals and the Australian Open quarters. And then, of course, the big win over Jannik Sinner, which we'll get into in more depth. And then now today, backing it up against Medvedev. So to beat Zverev, Sinner, and Medvedev back to back, after not having won a title in 8 months and not having been in a final since Cincinnati and all the question marks going in, this has to feel really good for Carlos.
Yeah, this kind of feels like Yannick's moment in Beijing last year as well, when he beat Alcaraz and then Medvedev. Like it kind of feels similar to me, just, of course, Djokovic wasn't, well, this time he was in the event, but he lost early. So of course that maybe could have been even like bigger, but still, yeah, as you said, I mean, he hasn't won in a while. He was, let's say, excellent in patches, excellent in some matches, but then it would all come to a crash. Usually not in the final, usually not in the semifinals, even sometimes in the semifinals. So it was a bit of a relative slump. Of course, we sort of have very high expectations for Alcaraz. He does for himself as well, and well, obviously he's earned those sort of expectations as well. So it's not like we're sort of just, yeah, putting a lot of pressure on him for no good reason. He still, is one of the most dominant players in the world. However, if we just sort of looked at results posts, you I usually say post US Open, because I think making the semis at the US Open, it's still a result, sort of, yeah, that's perfectly fine. Maybe not exactly what he expected, because he probably expected to be in the final of Djokovic, but like, let's say post US Open, the results that he was putting in, they weren't really, no, they were no match for Sinner, they were no match for Djokovic, they were sort of even no match for Medvedev. And that is kind of a big deal. And I remember I was thinking that, well, Buenos Aires, Rio, he wins one of these events, he gets confidence back. That, of course, doesn't happen. He loses to Jari. There's that Rio Ankle Roll where we said that basically, like, if it doesn't hamper his Indian Wells preparation, it's okay. But if it destroys his Indian Wells campaign, it's a big hit because this is one of his best hunting grounds. I mean, at least, you know, it's going to be. And I guess with this title, it already is. And yeah, if this actually in some way destroyed his Indian Wells chances, this would have been massive. This would have been a terrible hit for him going forwards because, yeah, he really needed a run like this. As you said, we're going to talk about the Sinner-Medvedev wins later on. Maybe the Medvedev one is less impactful, but the one over Sinner for sure. I mean, I think it has major meaning sort of to, for the rest of the rivalry this season, for example. And yeah, even the ones earlier. I mean, there were so many good narratives this week about Carlos. Maybe Australia seem less so because even though it's a negative head-to-head, we know that it's like, you know, indoor hard courts back in the day and stuff. And he won in Indian Wells in 2023 over Felix. Of course, this match was even easier. But against Marozsán, yeah, the loss in Rome, which definitely will sort of stand the test of time as one of the, I, of course, we've said it many times as well, like shock of the century or upset of the decade, whatever people were throwing around. That was not factual at all. However, it still sort of is a very famous match for sure. And also the one against Zverev, yeah, the Australian Open, to just sort of prove that on a very different court, on one that suits him well, he's going to be able to play much smarter tennis against the German. And he was able to do it. And in general, I guess, making sort of adjustments, problem solving over the whole week, over the whole fortnight was a big, big major strength for Alcaraz. And this is also connected to what you said earlier about like how this court, these conditions really accentuate the strengths and weaknesses of Świątek and Alcaraz, and especially the ones that they sort of have in common. And for both of them, like if they have that tiny bit more time to figure things out, they're likely not going to be like, yeah, just trying to go blow for blow with a more powerful opponent. But instead, they will have more options and they will sort of, yeah, use the fact that their skill sets are way more varied than the other top players. I mean, maybe Świątek didn't face the other top players, so this week it's a little bit of a different story. But for Alcaraz, of course, it's definitely relevant since he faced Zverev, Alcaraz, and even Medvedev, even with someone who's like so versatile like Daniil, that really holds up that like when you give Alcaraz that tiny bit more time, he definitely suddenly becomes a much stronger problem solver as well.
Yeah, for sure. The adjustments that he made throughout the whole week were very impressive. The sort of push and pull between, standing closer in on the baseline to return, albeit aggressive second serves. He did that, for instance, a lot against Medvedev. Medvedev wasn't able to win up to 50% of his second serve points, whereas in the first set, Alcaraz was at like 64%. So it just goes to show you he can be attacking there, but also give himself some more time on other second serve returns and move back. And I was impressed against Sinner, particularly how he was able to mix up the changes of space, pace, especially after, just going toe to toe with him from the base and it not working. Yannick really enjoying that, let's say baseline contest of both wings, of ball striking and kind of back into back end. He was beating him with the back end on the line that was big as well. And for Carlos, he needed to change something up, and he definitely did. He started using more backhand slice. He started hitting some more of those higher, loopier balls, heavier balls on the forehand to get the ball away from Yannick's strike zone and just, make Sinner finish against him, his speed, which is, his speed is really something that stands out, especially even more so on this court where, it's slow. Like you said, he has enough time, particularly the slice defense, but also just the high, heavy topspin and just so many great things this week also with, I felt like the confidence was back in his game. The mojo was back. The serving as well, in patches was really good. I thought at points this week. Other times when he needed the big serve, he ended up getting it. And, still, obviously, the spot serving is something he can continually get better at and work on. But I felt like the pace was consistently there, hitting 130s, 135s almost regularly. And so I didn't feel like it was that much of a factor in some of his other matches we had been talking about in the indoor swing, but also at the Australian Open, where you just felt like his serve was getting bullied by some players. And that wasn't the case at all at Indian Wells either. So I thought they were very complete performances overall. Like against Zverev, I was very impressed with his returning. Oh, he was returning Zverev's big first serves not quite a block return, but somewhere in between a block and a full swing, and just making Zverev generate in the wind, which was kind of a bit of a problem for him throughout the whole match, especially after they came back from the bee sting relay, which obviously everyone has been talking about immensely for 3 4 months, overblown with memes. And and obviously for Carlos, actually he did actually get stung, and so for him, he had a couple of hours there at one all in the first set to figure that one out and come back and just play a really sharp match right from the get-go. And it was he called it the best returning performance of his career after he won, which, yeah, big statement, right? But just goes to show you he was impressed with that part of his game as well. And then it was but sort of the first set against Sinner when he was blown away 6-1. What were you thinking at that time? Because we have seen big matches in the past where he has lost that first set pretty comfortably, but then he's found solutions, like the Wimbledon final, for instance, come to mind.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts were definitely pretty bleak at the time. I remember saying pre-match that, like, well, I am expecting a pretty tight battle because you have Sinner on that win streak, but you also have Alcaraz in Indian Wells. And, like, if he's not going to be beating Sinner at Indian Wells or on slow clay, like, where is he going to beat him? And that's kind of the main thing here. The fact that if Alcaraz was going to go down to Sinner again, and we just sort of see more of a, yeah, just more issues in this matchup and with how Sinner is playing right now, it could really be like a major threat to him for the rest of the season. And like Sinner still will be a major threat to him for the rest of the season. And this is where I will also note that, like, even though in the past, probably also on this show, we have referred to Sinner as like a problem matchup for Alcaraz, it's definitely time to sort of stop that now because, well, now we can sort of just consider them equals, and well, they're both generational talents. They're both basically at the same level for the moment, and it's not really something that stands out that they are so close to one another in the head-to-head. Some will say four all, I will say five for Alcaraz because of course I'm counting 2019 Alicante. But now that they are sort of dominating the tour in a similar manner, it doesn't stand out. So well, maybe I wasn't looking at it from that perspective anymore, that this is a problem matchup for Alcaraz. But obviously he has struggled to like neutralize the power from Sinner. And I think to me the main sort of maybe difference between the 2023 win, when I was just trying to remember it, because that was the last time Carlos beat Yannick in on the tour. That was also Indian Wells last year. The main difference was like that last time he kind of just had this miraculous get in the first set tiebreak, which made him survive the match, and it was
Set
like
point, right?
really 5-4, I think, but just very close to set point. It's set up set point, I think. And the thing is that at the time, like, it just kind of was decided by this one point, and there was a lot of defensive, yeah, just instinct, natural Carlos instinct, lots of defensive gets, the speed, the athleticism. This time, I don't even feel like he was playing that much on the back foot. Like, he really created a lot of forehand openings for himself, and not by just going blow for blow with Sinner. But really, yeah, again, just adding a lot of loop on most of these forehands, trying to go smart about it. And this was probably the sort of the big thing that we got from this match. When it comes to what the actual question from you was about, when it was 1-6 down, I definitely felt like there is a universe in that match because of how well Sinner was playing, how strong he was on serve return, going into this match, that there is a world where Sinner just dominates this match. But that would kind of mean that, yeah, like going forward, it's going to be a massive issue for Alcaraz this year because the next time he plays Sinner, especially on a court that's like less suitable for him, I just don't see it right now. Of course, like, I don't know, let's say they play in Miami now. I would probably still be favoring Yannick a tiny bit, but yeah, I mean, this was just such a crucial win for Alcaraz to just keep up with Sinner, because the last 6 months or so he was not doing that. He simply was really far behind Yannick the last few months or so, and this is sort of playing in his own. Let's say, I mean, this isn't a home court for Alcaraz, but if he's playing Sinner, this is where he should be beating him. This is where he will feel like he has the home advantage, sort of. For Sinner, it's going to be a quicker court somewhere. I don't know. Let's say if they play in Cincinnati, Sinner is going to feel like, okay, I kind of have to beat Alcaraz here, and that's normal, even though it's not like home courts for them or anything. And it's not even that Sinner has had amazing results in Cincinnati so far. He's actually lost it right in the second round last year, but that was after the title in Toronto. But like, yeah, I'm just talking about the conditions more or less that Indian Wells is kind of where, given how unstoppable Sinner has been recently, Alcaraz kind of had to do it. And I was definitely very impressed with how he went away from that, from just that willingness to trade with Yannick. And suddenly started playing front foot tennis without necessarily trying to overwhelm Sinner just pace wise. And this is something that Alcaraz has had struggles with in the past. So has Świątek, and we've been touching on this many, many times. And even as recently as the Australian Open, that's kind of how he lost the Zverev match, which, of course, again, court conditions, court profile, very different. And that probably helps. But it's still a major, major step forward. And that match with Sinner really has, utmost importance, I think, for Alcaraz regarding his confidence and just regarding how close he will feel to his rivals for the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely. And those adjustments, I mean, in the first set, Alcaraz had two winners and he was, it was 6-1. Second set, he hits 12. And he was able to find a lot more of those openings with the forehand, like you said, with just smarter point construction. And just, yeah, just first of all, he started serving better, which helped a ton. But also, it was he was really making Sinner doubt himself on some of those clinical putaways that every time Yannick had, because Alcaraz was able to turn the tide on him, and it was actually Sinner who was struggling with balls out of his strike zone and struggling to sort of finish and create, and it just completely flipped in a way where actually even the second set, when he was up a break at 4-2, he had to save a break point. At 5-3, he had to save a very crucial break point, which that 5-3 point is something that I will always remember. To me, that was the most important point of this match, for sure. Because if Alcaraz doesn't come up with that miraculous open stance, sliding backhand winner down the line, it's back on serve, and suddenly the flow of the match is very, very different. And now all of a sudden, Alcaraz is not close to winning this, or not close to evening this up. And I just felt like to come up with that shot in that moment was risky, but it was quite brave and courageous at the same time to save that set point that way. And also the way he was able to finish that second set with the drop shot, it was just it had a whole different feel to the match suddenly when that game finished.
That's why I can't really say maybe that in the second set he improved his serving all that much, at least right away. Like, he was still in trouble almost every service game. And yeah,
The last two especially was where
the
it was
last
an
two
issue.
of the break points, I can't remember what the first one was. I think it was just Yannick kind of feeding him a pretty cheap error, right? The first break
Yeah.
point. But
I
then,
think
of
it was a
course,
backhand that he tried to go down the line with and he just missed it. But he had been before.
But like the last game, obviously that point that you mentioned, that's going to be just it touches the line. But sometimes that's really all that you need to win a match. And yeah, that was by far the most crucial point of the match. Obviously, you still don't know what's going to happen in the decider. We couldn't really have predicted that after falling down a break in the third, Yannick was like going to fall apart completely in a way. Like, yeah, just suddenly start producing, a multitude of errors. But certainly that one break point, like, it easily could have still ended in two if he doesn't take it. And just the sheer fact that he was in trouble in most of his service games in set two kind of shows that, it wasn't a turnaround that came easy. Like, it wasn't just like, flip and suddenly the second set with that early break goes Alcaraz's favor. It still required a lot of, clutch play as well, but yeah, simply somehow getting through these service games and eventually running away with it, which maybe makes it an even more important win.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, we also had that point in the early third set where Sinner was clutching at his calf. And also the break point that Alcaraz won, the amazing get off of the net court, and then the backhand volley to finish it off. Sinner did fall at that moment, and then he like injured his left wrist or something like that. It didn't it appeared to he appeared to be shaking it at points in the match, and definitely perhaps maybe it was a factor in him falling apart physically, along with the calf muscle injury that he had. So, but that takes nothing away from Alcaraz, because I felt like he was still problem solving quite well. He still had sort of no business winning that break point with the ridiculous speed and gets there. And he was already kind of causing Sinner a lot of problems, and I felt like Sinner was still moving okay, you know, the rest of the match.
Yeah.
He was compromised physically for sure, but it wasn't really affecting his overall movement to the point where, you know, he had to retire, for instance. He didn't even see the trainer. So I don't know. I kind of think, like, you know, even in the Miami match, some of these matches are just so physical and there's so much athleticism from both sides that unfortunately this can happen, as great as some of these matches are. Like the Miami match last year, for instance, we had Alcaraz cramping in the third set. And I think he had some kind of a hand cramp there as well. I'm a little fuzzy on that third set, but I think overall, yeah, I mean they're kind of similar in the sense the guy who lost it 6-2 and they were physically compromised, but at the same time you can't take credit away from the guy who actually won. So I think it's pretty similar in that regard.
Yeah, over the course of the year, like whenever we were reminiscing that Miami match that they had, and in general that their clashes in the Sunshine Double, the fact that Yannick won in Miami, Carlos won in Indian Wells, which is kind of what you
Yeah.
expect with the conditions by now, at least. At the time, still Alcaraz was a pretty big favorite in Miami. Like, we never really mentioned the cramps, or we never really mentioned it as a, you know, why he lost. Like, there are losses when you definitely have to. Like, I don't know, Roland Garros last year against Djokovic. I mean, there's no reason not to really do that. Like, I think even Djokovic fans should be really mentioning that because, you know, that's kind of how the match was won and lost. Obviously, it was still, let's say, Alcaraz's fault or his lack of experience, maybe, that he arrived in the match in such state that he couldn't sleep at night before it and stuff. But, like, that's where actually it was super crucial. But, like, we weren't really talking about the cramps with Miami, and we're not going to be talking about these Sinner nibbles or however you want to call them. In Indian Wells here, because yeah, they just weren't like apparent enough. They just weren't, let's say, obvious enough for us to really be mentioning them as that, you know, that moment when the match was won or lost. It was still won by Alcaraz with, yeah, the great adjustments that he made in the second set, first and foremost.
Yeah, for sure. So then we go to the final, and now we have a rematch of last year's final, but this time you got the feeling that it would be a bit more competitive, that Daniil is more comfortable in these conditions, having made his way through the draw, some difficult matchups in there with, you know, guys he's lost to last year, like Korda and Dimitrov and Runa. And well, even against Tommy Paul, he was on the back burner for most of that match. I mean, until 3-2 mini break lead for Paul in that second set tie break, and he rolled his ankle, unfortunately. But some of the major things that caused Medvedev trouble, you know, attacking his second serve, coming forward, crushing and rushing, just playing really trying to get to net as quickly as possible, and just yeah, not letting Medvedev come settle in those long baseline rallies. And some of those things are exactly what Carlos Alcaraz does to Medvedev, and it causes him problems. But here in the first few games, it was actually Alcaraz who was coughing up a lot of unforced errors, and he made 8 unforced errors in the first 3 games, really cleaned up his game from there. Once he was able to get it back to even, then it got to a tie break, and Alcaraz started to play a lot better towards the end of this first set. And you know, the tie break was a couple of sticky situations as well. You know, he was up a mini break, and then 5-4, he had 2 points on his serve, and then he comes in, but you know, there's a net court that just sits up for Medvedev. He gets passed with the forehand, and then on the next ball, he actually hits 107 mile per hour second serve that was this close to being out, and you know, Medvedev hits the return long, and that's just out as well. So another sticky situation, and he gets out of that game. And there wasn't really that much separating the two players in the first set. I thought they were quite even for the most part, and it was really not really won or lost by giving too much away. So once Alcaraz came through that first set, then when he got a break in the second set, that's when you felt like, okay, now the match is sort of wide open. It's tough to see Daniil find any kind of solutions to make this one more competitive, but I mean that first set was so crucial, because if he loses that first set, I mean, yeah, it's a whole different match.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like coming out into this match, I think Medvedev will still take a lot of positives from it. I know it might sound weird, like 6-7-1-6, but of course, like he really made sure that this was not going to be a repeat of 2023. He comes out, he starts hitting like a lot more aggressively, closer to the baseline. He's really not willing to just give Alcaraz the usual advantages that he has in this matchup, which is like, yeah, the serve and volley out wide, and obviously the fact that whenever Daniil is a bit too passive, the drop shot is going to come in. It just made these opportunities be a little more scarce for Alcaraz, or you know, just so that Carlos had to execute a little bit better on them if that happened. Worth remembering also that like both guys had not won a title in a while, right? So Daniil was maybe facing a lot of the similar sort of pressure because yeah, he's lost five finals in a row right now, and maybe he's been making finals contrary to Carlos post US Open, or at least US Open and onwards, but he hasn't been winning them, so it was like also pretty crucial for him. Then again, we have to remember that Medvedev played Djokovic, Sinner, and Alcaraz in all these finals. But anyway, I was still impressed with what Medvedev brought to the table today. I think definitely some of that aggressive version of his game that we saw at the Australian Open when he was very tired against Zverev and Sinner. And we were sort of just that's what we were saying after Melbourne, that like it never will be like the main part of his game. It probably shouldn't be either. However, if you can just sort of bring that out whenever it's necessary, whenever it's convenient, whenever that would be helpful, that's kind of how he can make progress from here. And I think this final in Indian Wells was actually a pretty solid representation of that. Yeah, Medvedev takes the first set. Suddenly there might be some nerves. I mean, the tiebreak kind of made me feel of the US Open, right? Their semifinal, because that's kind of what happened there, that like Medvedev comes out. Well, maybe he wasn't playing as aggressively as today. Maybe he wasn't as close to the baseline, but he was definitely like out-serving Alcaraz there. Today, maybe not so much, but like anyway, one way or another, he gets to the tiebreak. And then suddenly at 3-all, when the pressure is high, when they're still going sort of strong, when they're still going 50-50 all the way until the tiebreak, Alcaraz just kind of loses his mind there at the US Open for a few points. And that's kind of, you know, that really steers the match into Medvedev's favor, makes him go two sets to love up. And then, you know, you just have so little margin in order to come back into it. So this could have happened here as well. And as you mentioned, like this tiebreak had so many twists and turns. 5-2 up, I was already like, okay, so Alcaraz is going to win the tiebreak and the match. I mean, that's kind of a foregone conclusion. But yeah, then that net approach at 5-4 was pretty horrific. And to somehow get over the line here, not this time, not falter on the 5-0 point, or even the 6-5 point to win it on return, certainly felt very crucial, especially maybe in the best of three format when you really don't have any time once you lose the first set. So it could have gone kind of either way in the opener for sure. But all in all, you kind of could see perhaps especially after these 12 minutes, the eight unforced errors that you mentioned from love three down, Alcaraz was definitely the better player. And I guess the main difference between this and the Sinner matchup, that like while Medvedev was really taking the game to him for the first few games and also kind of trying to just trade with Alcaraz, go blow for blow with him a lot of the time, against Daniil, he can actually pull it off. Like on these courts, he had no issues. Against Sinner, yeah, he has to be a little smarter about it. But here he was able to like be both flashy and efficient at the same time, regardless if he was defending and maybe yeah, just shrinking the court a little bit for Daniil, or if he was just trying to out-hit him. So it's still a very good matchup on slow hard courts, but I was impressed with how Medvedev did not just yeah, play the same match like in 2023 and hope that it was gonna work this time. But he really had an idea for it. He had a plan. It almost worked out in that it almost gave him the first set. After that, sure, he goes down. Maybe the last few games, he doesn't really play at the highest focus and intensity anymore either. But we can't say that he didn't try today. He did try and made Carlos earn it.
Yeah, very much so. And we saw a lot more adjustments from him just in the return position as well, not standing so far back, but moving in sometimes as well, taking some of those balls a bit earlier, also upping up the aggression on the forehand. At one point, he was 80, averaging 82 miles per hour on his forehand, particularly going cross with Alcaraz and actually getting some misses from him, or if not getting misses, at least getting something shorter to work with. The problem also is against when Sinner plays Alcaraz, he can just generate pace off of no off of nothing to work with and hit winners, especially from the middle of the court, whereas Alcaraz has to kind of get Medvedev to do that, and so he has to be very patient. He has to, at the same time, he's never really under too much threat offensively apart from the serve. So once he gets the serve back into play, and once they're in kind of a neutral rally, then it's kind of up to Medvedev to up that aggression level. Otherwise, he's kind of in trouble. Whereas against Sinner, like he's really, Carlos is really never safe for most of those rallies. So I feel like at least against Medvedev, he feels like he has more time. And especially on these lower courts, that probably gets accentuated even more. And yeah, I mean that's why I thought Alcaraz was really just able to pull away in the second set. And yeah, like you said, it was just such a good win though, because he still had to problem solve, you know, win, get through that first set, and to not lose focus also in the first couple of points. He was down love 30 in that first service game. I thought that first service hold actually at the start of the second was pretty important, because recently in some of these losses from Alcaraz, we had also seen some like concentration dips after a really tight first set. So like even some matches where he'd win the first set, like I remember watching him play Dimitrov in Shanghai. He wins that first set, but a little bit of a drop off start of the second set, and all of a sudden it's a danger match. Or like those losses like Medvedev at the US Open, or I don't know if there's really that many other examples since,
Jarry
but
kind of counts
Jarry, yeah.
recently. Yeah,
Jarry
I mean
Buenos Aires,
the fact
exactly.
that he breaks right away after the tie break and then just kind of,
Yeah.
the lead goes away in a flash without even like Carlos feeling like he has a shot in that game. Like I don't know, he throws a few random shots away. Yeah.
Yeah, so all those things I feel like were just really positive for him, and now just to get back to another title, having, you know, that drought being over and that monkey off his back. I think that is a very good thing for him going into Miami, which he's obviously won before, 2022. Last year he made the semis as well. So all of a sudden this year for Alcaraz is looking a lot better, because also in the race as well, he's third in the race now. Yeah, he's third in the race now. And so he's still behind Medvedev at number two, but he maintains his number two position as well, because if Sinner passes him here or gets one round further, then he's the number two. So Alcaraz still has that as well. And Sinner's defending finalist points in
Yeah.
Miami miraculously.
Currently,
So
you don't know if it's actually good to be number two because you might play Sinner in the semifinals, right? And maybe Djokovic is gonna be in like a full-on slump. Who knows? Of course, Djokovic is not in Indian Wells anyway, so not in Miami anyway, so it would still be Alcaraz Sinner. But yeah, he stays at number two, and as you said, number ATP race, he is third, 1,400 points behind Sinner. So it sounds like much, and it is. However, yeah, the clay season is coming, obviously, and if there's one area where we like still haven't tested Jannik in a way, and not that he hasn't played the clay season, not that he hasn't done well in the clay season either, but I guess there's just one sort of part of the year that he hasn't demonstrated he can be winning big titles in yet. And
yeah.
definitely, yeah, that violent hitting that he produces, which is still, his main strength, despite being so sort of like high margin and pretty safe right now, it's going to be a bit easier to neutralize. One of the matches that I always sort of think about is Sinner Rune last year in Monte Carlo, right? Like that win for Holger does not happen on any other surface, really, or on even on a faster clay court, it probably doesn't happen. But there he was able to somehow, especially because of these the rain delays and like how the conditions got even slower, even heavier, he was able to navigate it. So yeah, going into the clay season, there should be some opportunities for Carlos to chase down Sinner. But of course, on the other hand, you can also say that Jannik, if he has a surprisingly good or like better than expected clay season, the chance for the number one ranking will be very real for him.
Yeah, definitely. Any other talking points for Alcaraz? Of course, he's also defended a title here in Indian Wells again. And so I think someone was kind of asking me on Twitter about what's the similarities between Indian Wells and Madrid, because obviously now he's won two Masters 1000s in both. And I sort of responded by saying that, you know, the ball travels pretty quickly through the air in both tournaments. So that's one similarity. And also the kick serve for Alcaraz on the outside most notably gives him an instant forehand to do damage with off the next shot. So there's that as well, which, you know, for the most part, I remember him playing Djokovic, for instance, in 2022 in Madrid, and he only lost his serve once. And he's just able to protect that shot a lot better. And I think also the lively bouncy courts in general are just great for getting the opponents, you know, getting it away from your opponent's strike zone, and also just hitting it hard and pretty heavy. And I think Alcaraz enjoys that quite a bit, because he can generate such great power when the ball is sort of shoulder height. So yeah, I mean, it proves to be pretty good for him, these two venues.
Yeah, he's best on the tour. I mean, I obviously agree with what you said. I think I saw a question about this recently, maybe more so as well, more so like directed to to people on Twitter, not necessarily at me, but I think what was already stated in the question was actually from I think it was Amelia maybe. But anyway, what was already stated in the question was the kick serve. But yeah, I basically said something similar that the desert air in Indian Wells plus the and the altitude in Madrid, like we can see a bit of a correlation there. And also, yeah, just slow, hard, fast clay. Like it kind of comes together in terms of the speed too. For Carlo, I guess this is obviously the same for Świątek as well. It's a little different for sure because, well, she's going to be a bit more vulnerable in like faster clay. She's going to be a bit more dominant than Alcaraz on slower clay. But
Yeah.
yeah, we can see how that sort of comes together for Indian Wells being like a perfect mix for both of them in many, many ways. Alcaraz is going to be slightly better probably in general in like natural surfaces as well, whereas Świątek still needs that, to fine-tune that grass game. But we can see how like both of these worlds really mix up in Indian Wells. So yeah, I mean, over the years we should definitely expect a lot of titles from both of them in Indian Wells. Madrid is probably going to be more of a Carlos Alcaraz thing rather than Iga Świątek, but of course it's a clay big event. I mean, she's going to be one of the favorites to win it every single year as well, if she plays it, because there's been, I guess she hasn't, she also skipped it in the past, but last year of course she loses in the final to Aryna Sabalenka, so it was also a perfect, perfectly fine performance, one of the best matches of the year. So it's not like she's not going to be a contender, and of course with Madrid we actually have that home soil thing as well, and Carlos playing at home, that probably does play into it a little bit more too.
Yeah.
No one really
Good
mentions
point.
Barcelona in these conversations, but yeah, I mean it's not a court that's as perfect probably for Alcaraz as Madrid or Indian Wells, but he's still gonna be winning there, a ton.
Yeah.
The field is slightly
It's like for
weaker.
Stuttgart. Stuttgart is a
Oh
bit faster
yeah.
clay than Rome. For
Yeah.
Carlos, slower clay in Barcelona, and Iga's dominant in Rome, Carlos so far in Madrid. But so yeah, there I see what you're saying.
Indian Wells kinda is like the perfect mix for both of them. That
Yeah.
let's say their court preferences are pretty similar, but they do have some very serious differences. But for Indian Wells, they're both like so excited, and they're both going to be the main favorites basically for this event. I mean, for the foreseeable future.
I mean, they might end up being, the most winningest Indian Wells champions ever, because just because I mean, for on the women's side, no one's really won more than two titles ever,
Yeah, on the women's it's
and
really
on the
easy,
women's side,
right?
it's super easy for Iga to
You
beat
have to
that.
beat Daniela Hantuchova.
Yeah, Dehova, but also Navratilova. They both have two each, and it's like, yeah. But for Alcaraz, it's also doable. I would say he's 20 years old now. He has two of them. Djokovic and Federer have five each. Don't know how many more Indian Wells Novak is even going to play. So, yeah, I mean,
It's more likely than not that Djokovic is never gonna win Indian Wells again.
so we can say that, yeah, he's going to have many more bites at the apple, and having had two already is definitely a big achievement. But yeah, and obviously, what else? In terms of storylines for Alcaraz, I think that's about it. I mean, just three more top 10 wins as well. So he's kind of proving himself, and also just improving these head-to-heads as well. I think is going to be big for him as well. Particularly the Zverev and Sinner head-to-heads, I would say those are a couple of major ones here. Against Medvedev, he had a head-to-head advantage, but still, you had the US Open performance, and
Yeah,
so.
Zverev is the weird one, right? Where like he is trailing that head-to-head, but anytime he wins against Zverev, it's
It's
a
so
blowout.
dominant. Yeah,
Yeah, so like with Zverev, I'm kind of like this matchup can always sort of reactivate. Like Alcaraz might win this three or four times, but then they will play each other. The circumstances, the external factors will come together, and suddenly the issue is there again. Whereas with Sinner, it's definitely sort of the most important win matchup wise. Yeah, the fact that he's able to like, I don't know if he's gonna be treating it as their ninth meeting or their eighth meeting, regardless if it's even or if it's Alcaraz with a lead of one. Definitely, I think for someone like Carlos, it was probably like absolutely vital to get this after losing to Yannick twice in the latter half of 2023.
Yeah, and just actually one last thing on the
I'm
alcohol.
sorry, I said latter half. After Wyndham Wells, after Indian Wells in 2023. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew what you meant. For Alcaraz and Sinner, they're obviously really good friends and fierce rivals on the court. And before the match, they were kind of chatting and walking together and just being really friendly and nice towards one another. And there's a lot of people who love that because they're like, it's kind of cool to see that. Because these two grew up with each other, they genuinely like each other. Then as well, they want to beat each other, and they're going to be playing many big matches over the next 10 plus years, hopefully. And it will be really fun to watch them go at it. But then there's also other rivalries where they have a little bit of needle and friction, and this is not one of those right now. But it is certainly possible. Maybe I've heard some people say that if one of them gets on a streak, and starts winning many matches in a row, maybe they'll distance each from each other and they won't be practicing together as much, and they won't be as close and lovey-dovey, versus if they kind of keep trading matches like they are now, maybe that'll continue. Who knows? But whatever it is right now, I kind of enjoy the dynamic because I like kind of seeing that nice friendship off the court and then fierce rivals on the court. It's kind of a good mix.
I
But
like
yeah,
some
listen.
drama. I like some bickering. But
I know.
yeah, I mean, I agree with what she said that as long as sort of they are threats to one another, but one isn't, clearly ahead of the other, or at least it's not Sinner ahead of Alcaraz, because, sort of for the past few years, I guess Sinner has been in Alcaraz's shadow. Now he's climbed out of it. So probably Carlos would be the one who like could be hurt more if Yannick has a prolonged, well, he's kind of had a prolonged period of, yeah, just being far too good to for anyone else. However, they weren't playing in that time frame, right? I mean, they only played like sort of the very beginning of that Yannick streak in Beijing. So, but yeah, I get what you mean. Obviously, it's a very individual thing, sort of whether you
Yeah,
kind of
it's a
like that
total matter of
dynamic as
preference.
a, yeah, and even for players, right? Like
Yeah.
if you perform your best in that sort of dynamic, if you're like having fun on the court, which I think Alcaraz kind of does, all these shot making beauties that we've had with Evans or like, I don't know, Tiafoe, where they just high five each other and have a lot of
Yeah.
fun, right? Like, I think that's kind of the scenario where Carlos performs the best because of how. And he's so much of an entertainer and like, yeah, just likes to go for the flashy shots sometimes, maybe not the most effective shots. Whereas there's definitely going to be players who like need to hate their opponents in order to perform their best. But again, yeah, that's like a very individual concept. So if it doesn't stop them from being these fierce competitors on the court and from being, yeah, just producing such high quality displays against one another, there's nothing wrong about it for sure.
Yeah, I like what you said about him, entertaining as well, because he's different from a lot of players in the sense that a lot of guys just go out there and they play tennis. I feel like he performs tennis. So that's the difference, because he's looking to, entertain the crowds while he's at it, have fun, feed off of that energy. And yeah, that kind of when he's in that kind of zone and mood like he is this week, that's when he's gonna play his best tennis, because he's gonna feel like he can really create and find that nice balance, I would say, between, disciplined shot making, but also, still having that, showing off that vast array of shot making and athleticism. But then, there's also Holger Rune, who's probably just chomping at the bit to just stop this duopoly and just and play spoiler here and, be like that third wheel kind of person. So that's what makes this really interesting too.
Yeah, I think they could use Holger Rune. They could use a Holger Rune. And I still, of course, I've been saying that for ages now, but I still really want a final, a big final. Hopefully a slam, but if not, let's say an ATP 1000 final between Alcaraz, Sinner, Rune, or anyone younger works. Like if it's an Alcaraz Fonseca final in Madrid, I will welcome it, but
Yeah.
yeah. Between these three specifically, or between any combination really of these three, a big final between them would really be amazing for tennis, I think, and for its sort of development, for yeah, how big of sort of what sort of stars these guys can become. And yeah, I mean, if Rune gets there, that would be for him, I think, right now that would be really needed. He's he's improved recently. I mean, Acapulco, Indian Wells, these are positive performances.
Yeah.
Maybe he can get to Yannick and Carlos pretty soon.
All right, and with that, we should also Move over to the women's side because Iga Świątek does it again, and she wins this title, dropping just 21 games in total in these five matches. And essentially, the storyline coming in was, okay, she has an Australian Open type draw again. She has Collins in the first match, and then Noshkova, and then also Rybakina and Ostapenko in her section, and they didn't end up getting there. Rybakina pulls out with the gastrointestinal illness, and Ostapenko loses early to Kerber. Or wait, yeah, to Kerber. So Ostapenko loses early to Kerber, and then at the same time, yeah, you have Collins and Noshkova. So once Iga comes through those matches and slow starts against both opponents, right? Against Collins, it was very even for about 6, 7 games. Same thing with Noshkova. Against Noshkova, she was down 2-4, 15-40. And then she comes out and wins the next 10 games, a very crucial 3 breakpoint saves to avoid going down double break in that first set. But once she sort of survives these two matches, then you're kind of like, okay, who is really going to stop Iga in this tournament? This is kind of hers to win, and if she doesn't win this, it will be surprising. So that's what ended up happening, and she ended up coming through very comfortably in the end. And a lot of her second sets were pretty one-sided, but she was kind of made to work at times, particularly even in the final today. I was impressed with Sakkari's comeback from love 3 down and making that first set competitive, kind of like what we talked about with Medvedev, just a close first set, and that it, at moments it certainly felt like it could be even more even, or it could have gone either way, but. Once Iga was able to pull away and just find her groove again, it was always going to be an absolute monster task to stop her. And obviously, I don't need to mention it again, but my favorite stat right now is when she does win that first set at the WTA 1000 level in completed matches, she is undefeated. So that streak continues. So does all these master titles. And right now, it's this kind of the simple thing that we're saying in all these streams, basically, which is that courts like this, Doha, Indian Wells, slower hard courts, slower clay courts, or yeah, just any of those kind of surfaces where she in tournaments where she's excelled before, we still put her as a favorite. And even in the faster conditions, we usually put her as a percentage favorite, but then we kind of look at who is in her section more carefully. And for the other slower tournaments, it doesn't matter as much. So that's kind of the approach we've been taking. And so far, Iga keeps proving us successful.
Yeah, a lot of things I have to touch on. I'm not even sure where to start, but yeah, we usually put her as that percentage favorite, even for things like Wimbledon, because
Yep.
she just has supreme consistency over players like Rybakina, Sabalenka. And this is kind of related to this week as well. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to tell you that Świątek had an easy draw in Indian Wells. But what exactly constitutes a tough draw at the on the WTA Tour right now? Like at the Australian Open, we were saying that having Collins round two, Noshkova round three, this is tough. And
Yep.
well, that's the same thing here. Like she still has to face these players here. Of course, she handles them much better, and not without issues, as you said. There were some early breakpoints, and especially the saves against Noshkova were great because she wasn't playing too well up until then. She wasn't playing too smart either, but then suddenly really brings out like the best of her tennis out of her tennis, on these breakpoints. So that was pretty clutch. After that, Noshkova goes away completely, and yeah, she doesn't win a game after until the end of the match. But like, yeah, she's not going to be playing Sabalenka, Rybakina, Goff every single tournament because these players often will not get to these stages. Of course, she played in Doha. She played Rybakina, which is great because this is like literally the only match that Świątek has played this year where she wasn't a massive favorite. Otherwise, she's like always, the overwhelming, let's say, betting favorite, but also, in the eyes of the public, the eyes of the media, she's always the overwhelming favorite, even when she was losing, of course, to Noshkova at the Australian Open and Kalinskaya in Dubai. But like, yeah, I mean, these players are just aren't as consistent, and I think this event kind of showed it perfectly. Because by the time Rybakina withdrew again due to that gastrointestinal illness or whatever the issue was, and also Sabalenka lost to Emma Navarro, like we just sort of looked at the draw and there was no one that could potentially stop Iga on a court like this. Whereas if you swap this, if you like said, okay, so Świątek is out of the tournament, Sabalenka is out of the tournament, and even if it was a court that was really suiting Rybakina, I wouldn't be looking at it like this. Like, I wouldn't be saying, oh, so Elena has won the title already. If it
No.
was the other way around, the third combination, as in Rybakina is out and Świątek is out, and you've got Sabalenka left, well, maybe the Australian Open the last 2 years kind of has felt like this, that Sabalenka has to win it. But like on most courts, most conditions, we're still not going to like be, sure, Arena is gonna get there. Like they just don't have the same sort of consistency. And maybe sometimes it might look like okay, so Świątek has had an easy draw to the Indian Wells title or something like that. That's the reality, like that we have a very clear top three, maybe top four on the WTA tour right now. And below that, there is a bit of a quality gap. There is also a bit of a quality gap in terms of like how much these players can threaten Świątek. Of course, if you get someone like Ostapenko in the early rounds or Collins or Noshkova, things might get tricky. Like some big hitter, especially if you're Świątek and you sort of struggle against these sort of players when they're redlining, taking the racket out of your hands. But yeah, it was always going to be tougher on a court like this. Collins and Noshkova weren't able to do it. And honestly, by the time she made the fourth round, like it was kind of clear that the title is very much, on her racket. Like she kind of has no excuse not to pick it up, and that's precisely what she did. Like she didn't really fail to deliver on that promise. She wasn't even close. As you said, I was also maybe impressed with a few games from Sakkari in the final. There was a patch when she was much better off the ground, definitely. And I think if I read a quote just before we started recording from Sakkari from her press conference, where she mentioned that 4-all game that we were talking about, where Świątek just wins 4 points with unreturned serves, one of them ace three unreturned serves. And Sakkari was like kind of blaming this on herself that she missed three backhand returns in that game and that it's, this can't happen. I think, truth is kind of in the middle. Like it was still great serving from Iga. That one at the body, very deep, the ace, of course. So it's not like, I think Sakkari is exaggerating slightly, but I get what she's going for. Like I get what she's going for because that was the moment when she was really stronger than Iga off the ground for a while. And suddenly there's a game when she doesn't put a return in other than 1 point, which she wins. She wins the only rally. So that was kind of a missed opportunity, even though it never really became a missed opportunity. So I get why she really, picked it up as a very important moment of the match. And obviously after that,
Especially
she
since she didn't
doesn't
win
win
another game
again.
afterwards, so she could really zone
Exactly.
in on that one and be like, okay, because if you're thinking critically, like you kind of have to, even if you weren't really that close. So makes sense. Yeah, overall, she was also down 4-1 against Wozniacki, and I felt like that was a moment where, okay, like that was maybe the slowest start. That was the slowest start she had all week, and where I felt like she wasn't really playing well at all. Like her timing just wasn't there. Wozniacki was having a lot of success in kind of neutral rallies as well, and just Iga kind of not finding her timing at all in those day conditions. And it was actually windy as well. But once she put in a couple of deep returns back down the middle, and once Wozniacki wasn't able to hold for 5-2, then it really started to shift, and you really felt like she could run the match away from there. And then we didn't really get to see what the second set would look like because Wozniacki had the foot and toe issues. So. But a lot of these matches were just kind of very similar in that way that, you just had that kind of wait and see period for a few games in the first set, and then Iga just runs away with it before, and then it's over so quickly. I feel like that
Yeah.
happened.
The slow starts were definitely a thing, especially at the beginning of the week. Wozniacki, Collins, Noshkova. I feel like when a slow start happens against someone like Caroline Wozniacki, or in general, like against any defensive player over the last year and a half or so, well, since the beginning of 2022, let's say, it's usually just that. Like, she plays five, six, seven poor games. And then she finds her rhythm, and then the defense first player has no idea what to do because, they're just going to get bullied off the court. Of course, it was very different with Collins or Noshkova because they actually have the weaponry to keep Iga at bay. But yeah, it's just been so hard to beat Świątek playing, let's say, mostly defensively oriented tennis. It's only really been done since Wimbledon 2022 and Alize Cornet. It's only really been done in the Canada Cincinnati double last year, which was like one of the patches where, or at least, patches, two events where Iga really was struggling with her timing the entire fortnight, if you may. So, I mean, it's kind of impossible to beat her like that, and especially in a court like this. And clearly, whenever someone tried to attack her, it was also much tougher than usual. She, similarly to Alcaraz, like, she just doesn't really have to go Yeah, fight fire with fire again, go blow for blow with anyone here. She definitely sort of just instinctively can rely more on that speed, on that athleticism. She can come up with more inventive shots from the defense as well. But overall, this week, this probably didn't really like show up as much as we thought it was going to in Indian Wells because, yeah, the draw kind of opened up. She was mostly putting away the other players, with her offensive tennis, with her offensive qualities, with the especially with the forehand, and
The forehand was big
how on
all
a
week.
court like this, yeah, how on a court like this, it's just kind of unplayable and unmatched on the women's circuit in terms of the pace spin combination, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We saw a lot of times also with the backhand how she was able to go flat and hard with it down the line, and it kind of opened up an easy forehand for her, either in the middle of the court or just an easy put away. Sometimes a swing volley, sometimes a forehand right in the center of the court, and it was so hard for players to get her on the move. Because the forehand from the middle of the court was just so devastating the whole weekend. I felt like that was there for her throughout, even when her timing wasn't there. I felt like the forehand still had a decent amount of safety to it, on these courts where she doesn't feel like she has to hit through so close to the line. She doesn't feel like she has to go, like you said, blow for blow. So that when you have a shot like that becomes the biggest weapon all of a sudden in the game. Because yeah, no one really has that. Any of the opponents that she faced this week were We're close to having that kind of mix of pace, but also heaviness. So, that was huge. I mean, offensively, I've always said it's the best forehand in the game. And when you have slow conditions like this, it becomes even more apparent. So I think it was that was just one more thing that stood out to me. But I like, yeah, this whole week is really just everything we were expecting once those players lost. And it wasn't really as if, even if those players were in,
Yeah.
I would have still liked her chances. I would have still picked her to win them. Even against Sabalenka, Rybakina, I still would have liked her chances just because I felt like the safety and the margin is there and the reliability is there, particularly even if it was a final, for instance. I would still kind of be backing her, just like I did when she played Rybakina in Doha. So it really just comes down to it. Now I just sort of want to see what happens in Miami if we look ahead to the draw there. We can see that she's facing, I think, potentially Georgie in the first match, which I guess that is kind of an interesting one, right? Because Georgie can there's a quite a wide disparity between her best level and her average level, and if her best level really shows up, I mean, that's not an easy first round match at all. And
Yeah.
then potentially, yeah, Noshkova, like you said, in the next round, but those are the
Yeah.
couple rounds.
Like that's exactly the kind of player that sometimes can beat Świątek and sometimes can beat anyone simply. Like that's not even Świątek
Yeah.
related.
She
I
can also just
guess.
lose one and one and no one would be shocked. So
Yeah, of course.
there's such a
She has
disparity
been
there.
doing pretty poorly. I think she's out of the top 100 by now. It can also
Yeah.
be a matchup between the Polish matchup between Świątek and Frank. I've
Yeah.
seen that live actually in Warsaw a couple of years ago, but no, that was not a good match. And yeah, obviously Magda doesn't really have too much weaponry to hurt Iga with. But yeah, Miami, it's going to be about getting through these first few rounds, maybe again against Noshkova, who should have a slightly better shot at Iga here than in Indian Wells. And maybe, yeah, maybe by the time she gets to, like the quarters, fourth round, I still think she's again the percentage favorite. But if we're talking Miami, I'm not gonna be as convinced about her chances of, beating, let's say, someone like Sabalenka or Rybakina in the final. Whereas, yeah, in Indian Wells, I have to agree with what you said earlier that like it wasn't just about these players going out. The fact that these players went out, it just made us think, okay, so who is she gonna lose to here really? Like how is she gonna lose to anyone here on these courts? Whereas, but yeah, like if Sabalenka was still in the draw, I still would have been very convinced that Świątek was gonna win the final between them. Like if that was the final today, I would have entered this feeling that Iga will definitely win. Like that's the sort of confidence that I have in her in Indian Wells. And I was doing a watch along with Nick a couple of days ago, and he said that. I think it was about the Sakari final, where he said that basically it's like it's a funny thing how it works for people who are like fans of a certain player, because the Świątek fans will still be entering this final, feeling like a little uneasy and like, what if Sakari peaks? What if Sakari has a fantastic day at the office? Whereas, me as a more neutral observer, I was just like, yeah, no shot. I mean, this isn't going to be much, you know? And actually, I would kind of feel the same against Sabalenka. Of course, it would be very different because it would be a much bigger occasion and it would be a, yeah, just a much bigger thrill of that match. But yeah, it wasn't really about Sabalenka or Rybakina going out. She would still be the favorite, but suddenly it was just kind of hard to see a path to, for Świątek not to get the title. Something would have to like really go wrong in her performance in order to get to get to that stage. So yeah, I very much agree with that it wasn't even about that. It's just the sort of advantage that she has over the field, mostly really in Indian Wells and on slow clay. Like these are probably the events where we can feel like that. Like last year's Roland Garros, that kind of felt like it at the beginning of the event already, right? That something has to go terribly wrong for Świątek not to win the title. Like maybe she doesn't handle the pressure because obviously that sort of position to be in a position where you're like you're favored over the field, maybe even that is very tough to handle. Some of that we saw in the final, but yeah, probably Indian Wells and slow clay are the only conditions where we can like really go into an event and think something has to go terribly wrong for Świątek not to win.
Yeah, and there's a lot of events like that on the tour for her, so you know she's able to get a lot of those trophies in those slots in the calendar where I just feel like she can just extend her lead maybe at weeks at number one and also just get closer to that Masters record that we keep talking about of I think 10 is the record for amongst active players, which is Azarenka. Iga's currently at 8 right now, and that's even gettable this year for sure. So that's gettable this year for sure. Obviously, the 23 number for Serena is going to take a lot more work and many more years and a decent amount of consistency every year to get there. But with the increased focus on 1000s and just how many of these like at least four or five venues every year where you feel like she's a sizable favorite, it feels like it's certainly doable. But the Miami draw, yeah, if you wanted to say something on that, actually.
No, I mean, I just wanted to bring up because you mentioned numbers. You mentioned numbers ranking and basically worth. I guess it's notable that Świątek is also now currently the number one in the WTA race, which is pretty wild to think about, because she went out in the third round of the Australian Open. Arena won it, but she is currently with a pretty big lead. So, like, a good clay season, Roland Garros title, and it's very likely that she stays number one for the whole season, really. And yeah, 100 weeks is also secured. You mentioned the ATP, oh, sorry, ATP WTA 1000 stats and stuff. Yeah, basically, ranking wise, this was also a very important event for her in that sense. Sabalenka, after earning 2000 points at the Australian Open, has only earned 465 in the other events. Świątek already 3K for the season, so this is absolutely massive, 100%. And also, I just had one more, like a very quick question. Which was the more important title, Doha or Indian Wells? They're both 1000s. One has 5 rounds, one has 6 rounds, but also one had Rybakina and the other, well, Rybakina in Świątek's draw, and the other didn't.
Yeah, I think the Doha one really stands out because you have to come out of the Australian Open loss and really make a statement right away to the rest of the field. And so that one to me really stands out because of the Rybakina match, but also just that it was right after Australia and it is a venue that she's had even more success than Indian Wells, having won twice already. So for me, that title win was huge just to get that another win over Rybakina again. And just in her mind, that's a much bigger, that felt like a huge sort of relief that when she won that, just knowing that, okay, like I am still like kind of the player to beat this year. But this one just kind of feels like it's more expected. That one we there were still a few more question marks going in just because of that AO loss. So to always get one title right off the bat, right after that one, I feel like is huge. I know what you're saying, like Indian Wells, you have to win one more round, it's a bigger draw. It's a longer, it's like a 2 week event, but I still think that Doha one was even more significant. What do you think?
No, I'd agree with that. I think the Kalinskaya loss in Dubai was also like definitely not as harsh
Yeah.
as the
Well,
Australian
that's one
Open
you can
one.
just shake off of really
Yeah,
quickly and bounce. Like
because you
that's
won
not difficult.
Doha, you lose in Dubai semis. I mean, really, no biggie. Just like, for example, I didn't say it earlier, I forgot, but like for Alcaraz and Sinner, To me, Sinner kind of had nothing to lose in this match because, like, yeah, he lost the Indian Wells semi and he won the Australian Open. Like, who cares? You know, he's won so
Yeah.
many
But
matches
at
recently.
the
Of
same
course,
time, this was the first time he was actually the favorite going into the match, like betting odds wise
against,
in similar matches. So Alcaraz could really feel like he was the underdog here, where that wasn't
yeah.
probably the case in other matches before.
But like but basically to me, like, you know, I know that it's not gonna, Yannick isn't gonna feel like this, but like, yeah, he kind of had nothing to lose in a way, and it sort of was like this in Dubai, I guess, against Kalinskaya for Świątek too. Whereas, yeah, I would agree with what you said. I actually wasn't thinking of the Australian Open earlier and sort of that twist to it, but yeah, that also adds something. And even though it was four matches only this year for Świątek in Doha because Pliskova gave a walkover, I think Rybakina match changes it. Like, it's really a big deal because it was the only match in Doha or Indian Wells where you kind of felt really uncertain going into it, and you know, you knew that she kind of has met her match potentially. She gets, of course, that very tough tiebreak. So yeah, I think that was a more important win because yeah, Indian Wells you just kind of expected it already, and in Doha maybe not necessarily, especially when we saw that she was gonna play Rybakina. So
Yeah, the
obviously both.
Rybakina thing is huge because, like, she beat her three times last year, and the two of them were on slower courts. And you really, there was really a question: is there a matchup problem here? Is there, Rybakina is a legit, really, really big rival for Iga. So it's, and she has that consistency year round where you still expect her to finish top five, like, again. So it's, even with these, even though she might not be as consistent, a lot of that is actually health issues. A lot of that is, like either withdrawal related, health related, maybe an early loss here or there, like at the Australian Open. But for the most part, she's a
I mean,
formidable rival.
I think the best sort of stat to show it, I mean, is the fact that, well, we are talking all the time about that Świątek win-loss record. We actually haven't mentioned on the show, but 20-2 for the year. But Rybakina is 17-3 when she's played. When she's been playing, she's almost unbeatable. That obviously sort of is also maybe that Grand Slam bias that we have, where like we mostly remember what happened at the Slam because she lost into Blinkova there in the second round. But like otherwise, she's winning pretty much every match she enters this year. So yeah, I mean that they're both on
And
an insane win loss record for now.
that Brisbane final, over Sabalenka, that was like one of the peak performances you'll see all year in terms of like standard. So when she's in that form, it's scary. Like, it's, yeah. And then she wins Abu Dhabi as well, and she's the final of Doha. So yeah, the consistency has been there for the most part. But in this Miami draw as well, you also have potential like fourth round opponent. Could be Alexandrova, could be Vekic. Could be another like flat hitter as well. So, this, a lot of people were kind of freaking out about the Indian Wells draw, but to me, this isn't so straightforward for sure. Like, there are going to be some tests. Even quarters, like, I know, like, Pegula might not seem like that much of a threat at first, but in Miami, she plays really well, and she's made semis back to back years, and this could be the tournament where she finds the groove again. So, potentially Navarro or Pegula in the quarters. As well, but she has avoided Rybakina and Sabalenka and Ostapenko. They're all in the other half, so she would only face them in the final. And I guess Goff is her semi-final opponent. And yeah, maybe you even feel better about her semi than you do the other rounds. But it's
Yeah,
I don't know.
as I said a few times, like usually I don't really look that much into the future, especially in the WTA Tour, where like, you know, who can she play in the final? Like if she gets there, we'll see. But well, recently I guess Sabalenka, Rybakina, Ostapenko, they've been kind of proving that. They've been showing that maybe it's not necessarily worth it to go that much into the future. But yeah, as a whole, it's a pretty tricky draw for sure. I guess the main sort of maybe main thing that we can get out of this, and just also from that question that I asked you about Doha and Indian Wells, is that this event will be kind of like Dubai, where she doesn't need to do much here. Like she loses to Georgie here in the second round and nothing wrong happened. I mean, she just gets more play time on clay ahead
Yeah,
of the
more of
big
a break.
swing.
More
Yeah.
of a break before the clay
Like
season,
literally
presumably.
she loses to Georgie and it's absolutely fine. Whereas Indian Wells early loss, that's actually a big hit for her. Miami, I don't know how she is gonna take it, but like yeah, it's pretty much like Dubai, yeah, where a loss will be taken as okay, it's fine. She won Indian Wells. I mean, a loss in Miami is perfectly okay. she's gonna be still fully strong and like well, better pre best prepared for the clay swing. So there's really nothing wrong about losing in an early round here, especially on a court that's a little less suitable. As you said, quite a lot of big hitters in her draw again.
Yeah, for sure. And also we're not quite sure yet what the conditions will be like in Miami because last year it was quite quick.
There was a
It was quick
qualifying
for
today,
sure.
but I don't know if you watched any of it. I didn't. I didn't have
I
time.
did not get a chance to catch any of that, but I think
Yeah.
but I don't know if it's quite as fast as it was last year. It's certainly I expect it to be faster than it was in 2022 when she won the title, but I don't know if it'll be quite like last year where I felt like it was definitely on the quicker side. But we didn't get to see how Swiatek would hold up there because she had that rib injury and didn't play it. So, yeah. Potentially, she's also playing the Switzerland tie for the BJK Cup as well, which is a quick turnaround from Miami. So, again, it's probably not the worst idea if, I mean, it's probably not the worst thing for her if she were to, not go all the way this week. Just with that coming up and also the clay season, because it could be a quick turnaround from the BJK Cup, potentially being on hard courts, so then going back to clay for Stuttgart. I guess which would be her first tournament there. So, and Stuttgart is a venue she's done well at now, one and twice.
Yeah, I wanted to see if it says anywhere like what surface they're gonna be playing on in the BJK Cup. I know it's in BL, and obviously that's usually like an indoor venue. I guess that would be suggested, but yeah, I don't know. I will check on like a Beijing King Cup website or something if that info is already available. I don't know who you know which surface sort of the Swiss will choose, probably not clay, given that they're facing
I will.
Świątek.
I kind of ruled that out because I'm like, there's not gonna work
Yeah,
play
I
there,
agree. Yeah.
yes.
They're gonna try to give Świątek a pretty fast indoor court, probably, which could be, you
Yeah.
know, subpar preparation for Stuttgart. But, you know, that's something we don't really have to think about for the next month, I guess.
Yeah. But yeah, overall, another really good week. Still kind of just maintains herself as the player to beat still on the WTA,
Yeah,
but
Indoor Heart. The Beijing King Cup website already says it. Yeah, it's Indoor Heart.
oh, yeah, so well.
Also, the Swiss team, I don't know if you saw who's there, but like they're not bringing out. Well, I guess they don't really have any massive guns right now to bring out when Bencic isn't playing, right? But
Yeah.
yeah, it's not the
Victoria
strongest.
Vlahovic.
You've got Golubic as the top as the first player. Second one is like very much unclear. It could be Celine Naev, the youngster, or Jill Teichmann, maybe Simona Waltert as well on the team. So actually, it doesn't seem like the Swiss team is even that dangerous. But yeah, it could
Yeah.
kind of mess up Iga's preparation a little bit for the clay swing. We'll see how she handles that. But obviously, she needs to play to that Olympic criteria and stuff.
Yeah, that's going to be important, because obviously the Olympics, yeah, she wants to be able to
Yeah,
play that.
she's only
So.
played since the last Olympics. She's only played that one match with Romania in Poland
Yeah.
against Buzărnescu and Prisa Cariu, the famous matches. I think she only lost one
Six
game.
love, six love.
Yeah, one game against Buzărnescu and none against Prisa Cariu. So, yeah, that's why she's playing that. But anyway, yeah, that's not gonna be for a few weeks.
But yeah, overall, a very good week for Iga and Carlos. A good one for this episode to have it be our first time in a venue that we expect a lot more success from both of them. And we've already kind of touched on all the reasons why that is. And we also touched on the things they did really well and what they were able to, how well they were able to problem solve throughout this whole week. And yeah, as a whole, it was really fun getting to watch them. And mostly because they always played on the same day. And they always, Indian Wells really capitalized by putting them on the night session at the same time or days. Most of the time when they were in the day, they were playing, one after the other. And there was this cool interaction earlier in the week and the weekend before where they were, both like kind of just warming up, hanging out in the grass area. And they met for a little bit. We don't know what exactly they were saying, but, now here they are as the champions at the end. So. We will see if it happens any other time across the whole year. I mean, Barcelona and Stuttgart is always a good bet, given that it's already happened twice. Yeah, maybe we'll see it more often. But so far, this is
Roland
already a
Garros.
pretty good start. Yeah, Roland Garros, Olympics. You know,
Olympics, yeah.
yeah, these are all possibilities. So, yeah,
I'm
can't
good.
see
Okay,
anything
I'm
happening
gonna
there.
say something bold. It will happen at least at one of these events, Roland Garros or the Olympics.
I think I'm in agreement. Yeah. I think it can definitely happen at one of those two. Maybe one, maybe both. We'll see. But yeah. And with that, guys, yeah, we love all the interaction we're getting on Twitter, and the enthusiasm for these episodes certainly has grown. This was our 25th, so we're approaching kind of almost 1 year of doing this, and yeah, the clay season is going to be fun around the corner, Miami as well. So we'll keep you guys all up to date with more Iga and Carlos stuff in the future very soon. And with that, yeah, thank you, Damien, for this one, and thanks for all the listens.